sorry. This is Epi. This is the Book of John, chapter 2. I'm glad we didn't record the first 5 minutes. So the theme is the old is obsolete, the new has come, and Jesus is the restorer of Israel. And tonight we're going to go over one chapter, and there's a reason to it. John chapter 2, verses 1 through 12, Jesus is the bringer of messianic joy, who fills up the depleted resources of Judaism. Also symbolic of Jesus being the replacement of the old purification systems. So the purification system they had before is now obsolete to the purification system Jesus has. In 2:13 through 25, Jesus removes from the Jewish center any activity unworthy of true worship of God. Once again, symbolic of the old temple practices replaced by the new risen Lord. Also worth noting, there are some similarities to chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. It is worth noting. Okay, so the wedding at Cana is similar to Calvary. First, the presence of the mother of Jesus in chapter 2, verse 3, and in 1925 when Jesus was on the cross, Mary was there. The address of Jesus to his mother. We'll get into that in a couple seconds. But on Calvary, he spoke to his mother as well. The mention of the hour. He mentions it in John chapter 2. But also he says the hour has come. The mention of his disciples in both instances. The anonymity of the principal characters in the two episodes. So we don't have names in John chapter 2, nor do we have names in John 20. The first sign, the hour of Jesus, changing water into wine. And the last sign that John gives, the seventh sign, the hour of Jesus at Calvary. And lastly, the issue of blood and water from his side. Where in John chapter 2, Jesus turns water into wine. Just an interesting note. I thought you should like that. So we're going to talk about Cana. So this wedding was in Cana. Why would Jesus start his ministry in Cana? Does anybody know?
Yes. I don't know.
Oh, that's a good answer.
I have a question. why did he do it? Because when Mary asked him, he tells Mary it's not his hour.
Ooh, okay.
And then he goes and does it. I have Catholic friends, and we study the Bible. My friend, Catholic, she believes, she has a lot of faith in Mary. And they use Mary, as you know, as in she intercept to get to Jesus. So that was her argument right there. And it kind of a strong argument if you don't know the scriptures. Mm-hmm. You don't know, more about Jesus. So she's saying, you know what, even though Christ did not want to do it because it was not his hour, but Mary asked him to do it. So against his will, he did it because Mary asked him because he was his mother.
Uh-huh.
That was her argument. And I know that's not true. My question is why the Lord did it even though he said, it is not my hour yet.
Teresa, that is an amazing question. The answer is two words. Stay tuned. We're going to go over that. Exactly.
That really caught my attention.
All right. I'm so glad you're excited. So my question, though, was why would Jesus start in Cana? The town is only mentioned several times only in the book of John. So there's no Old Testament significance to Cana. Josephus, a Jewish historian, only mentions it one time. So now, today, there are possibly two different locations for Cana. We don't know where it's at. So why would Jesus perform his first sign here? Well, we're only left to opinion, and that it may be his willingness to start in obscurity, as opposed to starting in the temple saying, it has begun, I am here. He starts in a no-name town. It's also important because people would not be from Cana. There were no prominent people mentioned being linked to the wedding in Cana. And it's also believed that Cana is where people lived that were generally poor.
So maybe because his hour had not come.
No, seriously. Yeah, yeah.
It was okay because nobody was maybe going to notice.
Yeah, maybe.
Or nobody would remember after.
Or they were so nobodies that they weren't going to go around and tell anybody.
That's another possibility. So a little background about a wedding feast. What would a wedding feast look like and what's going on? What we don't know exactly about this wedding feast. Was it religious or was it a civil ceremony? I don't know. Was it conducted by a Levite, a priest, or an elder? How big was that community in Cana? Once again, we don't know because we don't have that many records. What we do know is that usually the people getting married were betrothed, and to be betrothed was a legal act. As you remember about Joseph and Mary, they were betrothed before they were married. So basically, you know, a person gives a dowry. They say, you're worth 7 camels. And you know, here's your dowry up front. So in case I die, you have money. And that person, that female, will then change her cloak to show everyone, kind of like a ring, I'm taken. Don't even mess with me. Because if she were found to be not a virgin on their wedding night, then she would be stoned. She would be killed. Now, you were able to get out of being betrothed, but it was the same process as getting divorced. So it was a big deal. So, as opposed to today. Today we had the concept of runaway brides. We make movies of it. Cold feet. You know? But yeah, to break a betrothal was very serious. Now the day. The wedding day. They didn't wait for summertime, you know, to a nice country area. See, the day was, if it was on a Wednesday, it's only because the bride was a virgin. But if it was on a Thursday, it's because she was a widow. So there's reasons. Then the day's events. What would happen? Well, tradition says that the groom would go to their father's house and build an extra room. And once he was finished, not knowing when he was finished, his father would give him permission. Okay, go get your bride. Hence, you had the idea of no one knows the time or hour when the Son of Man will return because he is making our home. It's tradition. But when the father gave the okay, the groom with his friends would get trumpets and make a huge procession going down to his bride's house. She didn't know the time or hour, so she always had to be ready. Because she didn't want to look like, you know, all tore from the floor up. She wanted to look good. Because as the groom came, not only that, his groomsmen would come in with her and take her away. And they would take her away to her new home, the groom's home. And only some of the groomsmen were allowed to go into the home where they would have the ceremony. And then afterwards, there would be a feast that sometimes took a whole entire week. I gotta tell you, my wedding, I only had 12 people there, and we went to BJ's. It was only $500. I was so grateful because some people, yeah. Oh my goodness, like they spend thousands. So that was just a side note in case you want to write that down. But the uniqueness of the community, because we have 21st century Westerners' eyes. Now back then, community was a big deal. I have a quote here. Is that since it was communal culture, it was important that the neighbors would pitch in. If one gave a feast on such and such a quality and quantity, when his son was married, he was entitled to an equivalent when his neighbor's sons were married. If the neighbor did not provide, he could be taken to court and sued. A wedding feast was not simply a social occasion, but involved a legal obligation. It's crazy.
I'm glad that changed.
I'm glad that changed too.
Well, it makes me, I don't know.
Yeah, go for it.
Like, totally hypothetical why Jesus did it. Like, was he saving somebody from embarrassment or having to go through this. I don't know. So like I said, then,
two words. Stay tuned. We're getting there. So with this in mind, we get a bigger picture of the why. As we just said, you looked at my notes. Why would Jesus use this as his first miracle? Not for social embarrassment, but possibly to save the young couple from being economically crippled for years. Possibly.
Because they would have had to go get wine from someone else, and therefore they would owe it back.
Possibly. So, we're going to read the wedding feast. So, we're going to do it like this, okay? How about everyone reads a verse? So, we're all here, okay? So, we're going to start with Teresa.
I still don't have my scriptures. I'm sorry.
Okay.
So, it's okay if I...
Yeah.
I promise you I'll buy a Bible for this week.
You promise.
There's probably one in here.
There's
one? Actually, I have it too. There you go. I put on my notes.
So, what?
Actually, can you read two verses? Everyone, can you read two verses?
Yeah.
Cool, thank you.
So, John...
John chapter 2, mm-hmm. verses 1 through 12, the wedding feast.
What are the verses, I'm sorry?
Chapter 2, verses 1 through 12.
She's just doing one, two,
right? Yeah.
On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, why did you involve me?" Jesus replied, "My time has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do what he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so. And the master of the banquet tasted the water and had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine, first and then the cheaper wine, after the guests have had too much to drink, but you have saved the best till now." This is the first of his miracle signs Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He does reveal his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him.
Hmm. All right. Let's break it down. On the third day, verse 1. Now, scholars debate why John would even mention the third day. But the majority of scholars believe that it was the third day since he met Nathanael. So his disciples have been following for only 3 days. Others believe that it's symbolic, referring to the resurrection. A new age begins, represented by the new wine. And as we go into verse 1 again, it says, the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. So good news, Jesus was not a wedding crasher. But let's look at who was invited. Jesus' mother, not mentioned by name. As John is not named, he is the one whom
Jesus loved.
Yes. Maybe not to confuse her with other women named Mary, because Mary was a popular name. Outside resources mention that Mary is the sister of the groom. And there's also fragments that mention that Mary's parents were the ones that asked her to influence Jesus to help out with the wine. Seeing how she was invited, she could be a relative, a friend, or a neighbor. And unfortunately, we can't say we exactly know. We don't know. All we know is that she was invited. Did you know who was not invited? Joseph was not invited. Why? It's possible that he might have been dead at this moment. Jesus and his disciples were invited, possibly because of some of the relation to the couple. It was a close-knit community. Verse 3. So when the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." Now, in Jewish thought, wine is a symbol of joy and celebration. A rabbinic saying is this: without wine, there's no joy. So John writes about this tension. I want to kind of amp it up for you, okay? The wine was gone. This could be symbolic of Judaism. The joy, the life, it's gone. It could be prophetic, which is, this helps point to your question right here, Teresa, pointing to the Messianic age as time wine would flow freely. Socially, it's a major social blunder. Legally, the obligations are not met. I will sue you. And practically, the resources are gone. There is a problem. It could fit one of these or all of these. We don't know. But it was a big deal. So the question is, I just want to ask you, Bible scholars here, is did Jesus ever manifest his power in front of Mary before, to your knowledge? By manifest, I mean, did he do any other miracles? Or did he do anything supernatural before this, to your knowledge?
Besides the Immaculate Conception?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, not that's recorded, but she was told who he was going to be.
True.
It's all conjecture.
Todd, what do you think?
I don't know.
That's a great answer. Go on, what do you think?
I think that Mary remembered that Jesus, in very young age, Jesus taught some scripture to some scholarships.
Yes.
So that's the miracle thing.
That's a good point. What do you think, Teresa?
Don't know.
Don't know. Great answer. Last one.
Factually, there is nothing.
Okay.
But he, okay, what was he yes. doing in the temple, though, when he was 12?
Teaching.
Yeah, so that's not like a
that's,
miracle.
That's not a miracle.
It was not but a miracle.
But he was talking to the people who were, like, way learned, and he was, like...
And he grew in rapport
yeah,
with
he,
them,
he was,
in favor of men.
Right, he was speaking way above his age at
yeah.
that point. So there was something special about him.
There was.
Even if it wasn't miraculous.
She probably asked him to clean his room, and he went like this. He was 13.
I did not teach that heresy. I just want to... Okay, well... Let's just talk about more tension here. Not only are we talking about the tension with the groom and the bride, they're out of wine. But let's talk about Mary. At this time, the Spirit had already come upon Jesus. He knew who he was. He had his messianic consciousness. He knew he was about the Father's will. Being fully God and fully man the whole entire time, he had that consciousness. Don't you think that he would know that the wine was already out?
Of course.
Okay. Mary, knowing who Jesus is, wouldn't she know that he knew the wine was out? Okay. So if it's a big enough issue, socially, obligations, legally, all these things, why wouldn't he do something? Like, why would it have to become an issue? We don't know what Jesus did during his childhood apart from Luke chapter 2. As what Glenn mentioned, he was found with the scholars or the teachers, the rabbis, being way smarter than his age. But here's the main point. He may have not manifested any of his power for the past 30 years. Think about that. So if you're Mary, and you had this revelation from an angel, right? And she took it to heart when she saw him with the rabbis. And then she sees him grow up and she's like, just show me something, man. Like, just go like this and like make a rainbow appear. Something. Like, if I were Mary, I'd be like that. But 30 years goes by. Not only that, remember, to be betrothed was a legal thing. And here Mary comes as a betrothed woman to her fiancé, pregnant. Socially, she was an outcast. She was known as easy. In the book of Matthew, Jesus is known as a bastard. They had this social stigma their whole entire lives. And if I were Mary, I'd be so frustrated with Jesus. Like, come on, man. Hurry up.
Yeah, vindicate me.
Vindicate me. Hurry. And instead of being discouraged, she still came to Jesus expectantly. You may have not shown yourself for the past 30 years, but I just want you to know there's no more wine. And this is a great reminder for us. We may have a word. We might have a promise. We may have been encouraged by the scripture, yet possibly like Mary, we haven't seen anything change. God, you tell me to follow you, I'll have abundant life. Well, this is an abundant life right now. The bills are piling up. My life's a mess. Where are you? And I think it's important that we never lose our hope or expectancy like Mary. Just like Teresa, like I knew when I grew up, I had this kind of stigma against Mary. I never wanted to be for her. Because I'm like, I don't want to teeter on being Catholic. You know, and like, I don't want to, you know, put her on a pedestal. But when I think about her, I'm like, man, she is a hero in the faith. Mm-hmm. Just like David. Jesus above, for sure. So she went through so much emotional turmoil. She would have the stigma of sleeping around. Allowing any situation, though he already knows about it, she still gave it to him. And you'll notice that Mary came up to Jesus in verse 5 and will turn to servants. What is important is that the servants, knowing the problem, didn't go to the head waiter. So these guys know an issue. Who do they go to? Do they go to Mary or do they go to the head server? So, rather, Mary might have her the plight from them or in passing. And they came to her. Now the tension builds. Jesus, already knowing, responds, "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied, "My hour has not yet come." Now, if you're reading this for the first time, I can imagine you saying, "Jesus said, what?" Because in our 21st century, if I say woman in a certain way, it's like superiority, like machismo, like, woman, you're acting like a little girl. It wasn't like that. It was a sign of respect. Jesus had addressed a Samaritan woman and Mary Magdalene the same way, woman. It was a polite way of distancing oneself. Yet, we see Jesus loved Mary at the foot of the cross. He still respected her, loved her. But now he's taking some distance away. Through the provision of her after his death. So his response is this. He declares the beginning of his ministry. His freedom, ready? His freedom from human advice. Agenda or manipulation. He didn't say, "Mom." Woman. She had seen him born, grow, learn to walk, talk, learn. But now the relationship and any other family relationship had become subordinate to his divine mission. She didn't have the inside track. So the Greek states, Jesus' phrase is this: "What is it to me and to you, woman?" Questioning why he should be involved in the matter. And he states this: "My hour has not yet come." Now the hour mentioned is a reference to his death on the cross. But why mention it here, Teresa? Great question. John will use this reference 7 times in his epistle. Known as an internal prolepsis. That's a $10 word for literary reasons, always pointing to it, kind of like in a movie when someone mentions, you know, a cup, and then at the end of the movie you notice it was a cup all along, kind of like that. So it's putting that there, my hour, and then a few chapters later, my hour, until finally in 20, my hour has come. So it's a literary thing. But why mention that to Mary's request? Jesus could have mentioned it symbolically. knowing that the wine was symbolic of the Messianic age, it's not his time yet. Or he could be speaking of the future where he and he alone is the Messianic groom. Let's look at this scripture right here. Hey, Stephen, can you read that for us? John chapter 3, 27 through 30.
To this, John replied, "A person can receive only what is given them from heaven. You yourselves can testify that I said, I am not the Messiah, but am sent ahead of him. The bride belongs to the bridegroom. The friend who attends the bridegroom waits and listens for him, and is full of joy when he hears the bridegroom's voice. That joy is mine, and it is now complete. He must become greater, I must become less."
So, my hour has not yet come. What could it mean? Literary, John was trying to point it to his final hour. Symbolically, Messianic age, when he is the groom. And there's joy, and there's wine, just like this wedding feast in Cana. So Mary wasn't deterred, and May had not seen Jesus' statement as a refusal. She just said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." And I think that's very important to note that Mary was a blessed woman. We can learn a lot from her with little mentioned of her in the scriptures. There are some false beliefs out there about this woman, such as she ascended into heaven. You go to her, and she'll go to Jesus for you. She has an inside track. There are some false beliefs, but if we take it as it is, she was a fallen human being, given such a great treasure of Jesus, such a great purpose of raising Jesus. But she should have some credit for having faith to give birth to Jesus and raise him. And I wish I had faith like hers. If I became pregnant with Jesus, come on. But here's what's very important. Look at this. In verse 3, she approaches Jesus as his mother. But in verse 5, she responds as a believer. Whatever he says, do. And I think we should follow the last words that she's recorded as saying. Whatever he says, do it. Any questions about that?
Summary.
Okay.
Why was the first miracle done in Cana?
Oh, you gotta stay tuned.
That was a lot of info. So you can put it in a few words.
I'll address it in a couple minutes.
Okay.
And if I don't, please bring it up. Okay. So in verse 6, nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Now, the mention of the vessels used were what kind of vessels?
Stone water jars.
Stone water jars for what?
Washing.
Purification.
Yeah.
Purification. Ceremonial cleansing. So if I have dirty hands, can you give me some of that water over there? Notice it wasn't already the jars that had the wine in it. Question is why? Okay, cool. So he mentions 20 to 30 gallons. And I want to give you a picture right here. This is a picture of a 30-gallon fish tank. Now, if you multiply that times 6, you get around 210 gallons, which would fit that silo right there. So that's a lot of water. So before we move on, Jesus used ceremonial jars. Why not jars? The wine wasn't, I just asked. Scholars believe that Jesus didn't want to use the same vessels to show that he wanted to tidy up the old system of the law. Rather, he wanted to show how he changes things radically, water to wine. He doesn't need help with the old system. He has the power to change it radically. So in verse 7, it says, Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so. We don't know if Jesus knew the servants. All they knew was Mary, related or not, gave them instructions. Do whatever he says. Their masters would be greatly embarrassed if this didn't work. If Jesus said, "Fill it up, now give it to the master." And man, They followed his instructions unquestionably, filling the jars with fresh water from a well. Now, here's what's really interesting symbolically. Moses came, and what did he turn water into? Blood on the Nile, right? Representing the law. The law kills. Everyone is guilty. Stinking sinners. Jesus came and turns water into wine. Jesus giving grace and life and joy. The law kills, but through Jesus we have life. How awesome is that? So in verse 9, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have drank too much. But you have saved the best till now? Some commentators state that the wine was so bad that it wasn't doing the trick of giving them a buzz to notice the difference. Because if they had the good stuff, they don't care what they have after. Just keep coming. But now they were just drinking it and not feeling anything. But now, whoa, the good stuff. Now, Jesus had provided over and abundantly, not according to their need, but according to his riches. You'll recall John chapter 1, verse 1 through 5, and how it parallels the creation narrative. The word brings light and life, and through the word, everything was made. So John intentionally, either spirit-led or inspired, he places the story first, showing that the life that was once in darkness was now transformed. Transformation of water into a whole new substance. Who you were before Christ into a whole new person, just like Christ. And if I can ask you the same question that I asked Stephen, is this, you know, in our Christian culture, we're known as sinners. What do you think about that? Should we identify ourselves as sinners or as saints or as new creations? What do you guys think?
All of the above. The Mormon Church, mm-hmm. called the members the Latter-day Saints.
Mm-hmm.
That's how, you know, they're called them. So I think, in a way, it's a little bit of, you know, all of them.
Okay. Cool. I'll give you my take real quick. Is that we have a sinful nature. We're fallen humanity. But through Christ and following him and believing, my identity has changed. I am a saint. Not through the Catholic Church voting me in because, you know, I proved three miracles after I died, but by him. By him, I am a saint. By him, I'm a new creation. By him, in Ephesians, says, I am the workmanship. I am the poem of God. And so I just want to leave you with this one story real quick, and we'll have a quick break. Is this. My dad used to tell me, he said this, can't teach an old dog new tricks. And, you know, and he'd curse, or he'd have road rage, and I'd call him out, Dad, you know, can't be doing that. And he would say, can't teach an old dog new tricks, whatever. And he'd keep doing it again. And the thing is, like, I had a chill on that. I'm like, man, number one, we're not dogs. We're made in the image of God. And that we have the ability to transform and change because of his spirit. So if you have that mentality, I encourage you. Hey, you're not an old dog. So in verse 11, it says, what Jesus did there here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory. And his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and brothers and his disciples. There they stayed for a few days. So this was the first sign where Jesus Christ abundantly supplies all the needs of his people. Okay. So we'll take a quick break and we'll come back and talk about the next one. the next part. So this is known as Jesus clearing the temple. And here's the background. The Jewish Passover will be mentioned. And John possibly refers to it as the Jewish Passover because of the Gentile audience. Now, the Passover, do you know what the Passover is or what it refers to? Mm-hmm. Or what does it refer to?
We go back to the time of Moses and Ramses, you know, Egypt.
Yes.
When they're about to, you know, they were trying to leave Egypt, when they put the blood.
Yes.
On the doors of the, you know, the dead, I guess.
Angel of death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's it.
Yes, you're right, yeah. Moses warned Pharaoh of 10 plagues and to let his people go. And the last plague being the angel of death, that if you don't put the blood of a lamb on the doorpost, your firstborn will die. Threatening Pharaoh of losing his son. And so, you know, the Israelites do it. I'm sorry, the Hebrews do it. And, you know, the angel of death passes over. And unfortunately, Pharaoh's firstborn dies. Causing them, which was the catalyst to Pharaoh saying, just leave, go, get out of here. And so the Jews commemorate it. And it's not a feast like Thanksgiving, but it's a feast to remember. And right after the day of Passover is a whole entire week of called Unleavened Bread. And Unleavened Bread, it once again, refers back to Exodus when God instructed people to leave. Don't even bake your bread. Don't even put yeast in it to make it rise. Just take it as it is, as a little cracker that you have today, the matzah.
Yeah.
and get out of here. Now today, when Jews celebrate it, what they do is they put a little bit of leaven, a little bit of yeast inside their house. And what the kids do is they search throughout their house to get the leaven and get it out. And basically they're cleaning their house, they're purifying it, which is symbolic today of yeast being sin. Get that sin out of here. Which is a great segue because Jesus is about to clean house in the next verses. So, can someone please read verses 13 and 14?
Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem, and he found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves, and the money changers doing business.
Okay, so as pilgrims made up their way to Jerusalem, they did this for hundreds of years. And we read in the Psalms of how pilgrims would go up to Jerusalem to celebrate, to remember, to make sacrifices. It was also inconvenient to go up to Jerusalem because there would be bandits on the road killing people or stealing their oxen, stealing their animals, leaving them helpless and hopeless. And so it was much easier to buy animals at the temple. And of course, people can accommodate. Hey, I got to make some money. And so that's what they did. Merchants were outside in the temple, I'm sorry, the Mount of Olives, but now they're inside the temple. And just to give you a viewpoint real quick, this is horribly pixelated, but this right here is the temple. Huge, massive. And right over there is the Mount of Olives. So there's lots of room for people to have traffic. And we're going to get into the temple in a couple seconds. So, once again, they're at the Mount of Olives. But now at the time of Jesus in chapter 2, they made their way to the temple. How convenient. So, there were four areas in the temple that only certain people could be in. First, you have the court of Gentiles, where Gentiles can go. Then you had the court of women, the women's court right here. You had to be Jewish. And you can go in right there. Then you have the court of Israel, where only men, Jewish men, can go right there. And then only the holy place, where only priests can go. Four different courts. Now the thing is, if you're a Gentile, you can go pray, you can go worship, but don't dare step into any other court. Now there were signs posted saying, if you're a Gentile, and you dare put your foot into where only Israelites can go, you're dead. That's how serious they took it. And you'll remember in Acts 21 when Paul was accused of bringing Gentiles into the temple. And just to summarize Acts chapter 21, 27-32, it says this, the whole city, in verse 30, The whole city was aroused, and the people came running from all directions, seizing Paul. They dragged him from the temple, and immediately the gates were shut. While they were trying to kill him, news reached the commander of the Roman troops that the whole city of Jerusalem was in an uproar. He at once took some officers and soldiers and ran down to the crowd. When the rioters saw the commander and soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Now imagine that, coming to church. You have an area of only, say, a certain race can go here, and a certain race goes there, and if you cross over, boom, take a beating. Like, it's not a loving place. But so the threat was serious. Stay where you're supposed to stay. Don't dare cross over. Now, where were these merchants located? In the temple of the Gentiles. Sorry, the court of the Gentiles. Now, if there's Gentiles and pilgrims traveling all over the world, in a way, or all over Israel to come celebrate, and yet all these merchants are taking up so much space, and they have all their animals and all their money changers there, where can the worshipers go? They don't want to get beat. So that's the tension. Where do they worship? And to make matters worse, here we go. And to make matters worse, it's believed that greed got the best of these merchants by scamming anyone that they could. You had to pay a certain price for the best sacrifices, after all. You could bring your oxen all the way from Galilee, but I noticed a couple blemishes here, and the priest won't take it, or God won't like it. But if you buy this ox for $9.95, you know, and just taking advantage of these poor pilgrims who just want to worship God. The money changers, they would exchange money from people from all over the world. And at that time, they had emperor's insignia on it, his image on it. So you don't want to put anything with the emperor's face into the collection. So the money changers, I'll happily exchange it for you for a fee. So you see the tension? Jesus wasn't just having a holy tantrum. He saw the injustice. He saw worshipers being taken advantage of. So, prophet, yeah. So, as we can tell before we get into the story, the wedding feast in Cana and the temple are parallel. And John did this for some reason. These two stories are similar. First, the special occasion in Cana, the wedding. Here, the feast. The location, the groom's home, because that's where the feast is at. The location, the temple. Crisis, no wine. Here's the crisis, financial gain. People taking advantage of the worshipers. Religious, ceremonial jars, that's what they use. Religious, the temple. Jesus will say, you know, show us a sign. This temple will be destroyed, but in 3 days I'll raise it again. New. Water to wine, new. Jesus is the temple. So I just wanted to point out how John did this on purpose to point to the main idea. Do you remember what the main idea was again? The new has come. Jesus is the restorer. The old is obsolete. So now we're going to read what happened. So Todd, can you read it for us? John chapter 2, verse 13 through 25.
13 through 25?
Yes, sir.
Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem, and he found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves and the money changers doing business. When he had made a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple, with the sheep and the oxen, and poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. And he said to those who sold doves, "Take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of merchandise." Then his disciples remembered it was written, "Zeal for your house has eaten me up." So the Jews answered and said to him, "What sign do you show us, since you since you do these things. Jesus answered and said to them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Then the Jews said, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking of the temple of his body. Therefore, when he had risen from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this to them, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had said.
All right. This is going to be fun. You guys ready? Jesus' response, what do you think? Here these people are taking advantage of people that want to worship God. And Jesus just flips out. Stephen, what do you think, man?
I love it.
You love it?
Yeah.
Why do you love it?
Yeah. Protecting those who are taking advantage of, man. That's you gotta love that. I love that.
I love it too, man.
Yeah.
Well, it was his father's house.
It's his father's house.
Maybe that would be, you know, probably one of the main reasons he reacted that way. Very offensive to him.
So it was righteous. It was honorable what he did.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. People wanting to get close to God, and people taking advantage of that desire to get close. I mean, we see the same thing nowadays. People on TV selling a handkerchief, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, you'll be blessed if you buy this, and then your prayers will be answered. Like, same basic concept.
You just want to get the table and throw it. Get that out of my face. Well, you know, in a cutesy-wootsy way, when I would teach this to youth, I would say that Jesus was the first DJ, you know, turning tables. But I'd rather be more academic here and talk about how Jesus turned into a holy Hulk, right? And he's just,
That's funny.
Okay, good. I hope none of you are offended. Especially J.I. Packer.
And I was like, you know, Jesus was a carpenter, man. Like,
oh, yeah.
He would have been pretty in shape, man. He wasn't like the skinny, pale, like, you know, just going to sit in the frail. Corner with the whole... Yeah, frail, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a good...
He wasn't dainty.
Yeah. No, this dude probably had scars on his hands.
Oh, yeah. So verse 15 says this. He made a whip out of cords. Now, people will portray Jesus as what Stephen just said, a passive wimp, dainty, you know, peace and love. Hippie Jesus. But here you can see he knew what to use. He knew what tool would do the trick. Kind of like this. When your kid acts up, don't make me get the shoe. Get the fly swatter. Get the belt. The wooden spoon. Because I know what will hurt. So here Jesus knows, like, what has he gone through to know what would be intimidating and what would get the job done, other than him being all-knowing. Still, that's awesome. And he drove all from the temple courts. Now, it's interesting to note here, it's not referring to people. It's referring to both sheep and cattle. Jesus got these whips and these cords, and he's driving out the sheep and the cattle, and he was strategic, hitting them where it hurts, driving out the cattle because they would have to chase after their prophets. I think it's awesome because I forgot who said it, but he said, anger is momentary insanity, where you just lose your mind. But here Jesus turned into Holy Hulk, righteous indignation, and he was strategic. I know it will hurt physically, and I know it will hurt, you know, financially. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned the tables. Now, we don't know how much weight were on these tables, as what you're saying. But it doesn't say that the disciples helped him out turn the tables. His disciples were probably just watching like, what the heck? Imagine Pastor Ray. You're doing what? Like, who would just go in there blindly saying, you're doing it okay? What the heck? He alone had the brute force to do so, and no one dared stop him. You know, you didn't hear someone say, you're messing with my money, Jesus. You know, what's going on? No one. It's recorded here. And in a commanding way, he says to free the doves, get these out of here. Commanding them to stop turning my father's house into a market. And being a busy festival, there could have been easily 100 or more people. There was a lot of people that could have gone up and stepped up to Jesus, but no one stepped up to him. And why?
The response, I think, is hilarious. Like what they say, like, well, what sign would you give? Because you do this. They can't step up and because they were intimidated, so they did the best they could to save face. But, I mean, yeah, I love the response here.
Yeah, I love it too.
We should go practice.
Hey, go on, let's go to Panera and flip the tables, evangelize. And so as a man, as what Stephen was mentioning, and I think he looked at my notes, I really do. But I was going to mention that I love this picture of Jesus' humanity because he's relatable. Like, I would hope that if I were in that position, I would do the same thing. You know, kind of like watching wrestling when you believed it was real. And like you're I'm sorry, girls, but for the guys, like, oh man, I wish I could have done that. But remember what John said in the announcement of the word, that whatever Jesus does is like the Father doing. And this is a representation of the Father. And I love this picture of the Father is passionate about people not being taken advantage of. God cares about not stumbling others from coming to him for help. Also, his concern of what goes on in the place of worship. Whew. What do you guys think about that? Like, even in Revelation, we read how the stars are in his hands, and it's taught that the stars are the pastors. His churches are in his hands. Like, God is concerned about his church. What do you think?
Another minute
of
that, just awesome.
Awesome. All right, Kathy, I got to go to you. What do you think about that?
I think what he's telling us is that we need to be focusing on why are we here in church, right? There's all these extra things we can do on the side like these guys are doing, and we can turn it into something that it wasn't meant to be. And we're supposed to be focusing on God, just be worshiping God and not enriching ourselves or getting distracted by all these other things. And yes, taking advantage of each other, because people take advantage of each other in the name of religion. To manipulate people, to steal from people, to control them, all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just saying, hey, let's focus on what we're really here for.
Yeah. I think it's important, too, because, like, God, like, as much as we can complain about the Christian church, like, there's a lot to complain about, especially how there's so many denominations and how these things work. It's like, man, it's not great, but God is passionate about his church. He even calls it the bride of Christ. And I think that that's worth, like, just taking a moment thinking, wow, I can complain about the church, but that's your bride.
I think also we can, because I mean, we all feel like we get taken advantage of, and we get angry about it, and you know, it's just knowing how God feels about, you know, people taking advantage of his people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, easier to rest in that. That's at least that's what I think.
That's good. That's good. Yeah, I love this picture of Jesus. Like, he's not dainty. He's relatable. He's manly. Ugh. Sorry, I can't. So the question was that they had, as what Stephen shared, you know, these people, the only thing they could think about is this. What sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this? No one could argue against the righteousness of Jesus. They knew that they were doing this wrong. But they wanted some great sign, like a miracle, to prove his authority. And he gave them exactly what they asked for, but not how they were expecting. Jesus answered them in verse 19. He said, destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days. Now they replied, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to raise it in 3 days? Now you can imagine the Jews' response. You can't really blame them. Like, here Jesus is going crazy, and now he says, destroy the temple in 3 days, it'll be rebuilt. Now, they basically were saying, and you alone can rebuild it in 3 days? The reason why we can't blame the Jews for misunderstanding is because the temple was magnificent. It was beautiful. And here's some of the specs for you, okay? The brass gates were 130 feet high. So that's somewhere between 12 and 13 story foot building. The cut stones were 100 tons each. They were moved and cut without modern day machinery. The stones were 40 feet long, 20 feet high, and 20 feet thick, and they fit together perfectly. They said you couldn't slide the blade of a knife between the stones. And it's been estimated that if you construct the temple today, it would cost $1 trillion. So the temple was a source of pride for the nation of Israel. The willpower, the planning, the logistics, the arrangement to pull out this beautiful piece of art. The mind power, the architecture, the precision cutting, the brilliance in design. Like, I was helping my sister move into her house and I had to do some carpentry too. I have a crooked eye. I am so glad I didn't have to build that. Man, but the manpower, also the resources to build and fund such a work of art. And so they misunderstood and they rejected Jesus' answer. And John gives us some commentary. In verse 21 and 22, he says this, but the temple he had spoken of was his body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. So John gives us some of the behind-the-scenes commentary, noting that even when Jesus said this in front of the disciples, they had no clue what he was talking about. We see in Mark chapter 13, verse 1, it records one of the disciples' response to looking at the very same temple. In verse 1, it says this, as Jesus was leaving the temple, one of his disciples said to him, look, teacher, what massive stones, what magnificent buildings. Then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. So Jesus just said something to them that was unbelievable. Remember, these disciples, maybe 15, 20, we don't know how old they were. But as they came up to Jerusalem, they would see this same temple being constructed. Oh, it's getting bigger. Oh my gosh, you see all that gold? Oh my gosh, so all their lives, they know about this. And when Jesus said this is going to be destroyed, their mouths are going to drop. So I think that we need to have a practical note here. Is this, don't feel bad when you doubt. God uses doubters. Example, Moses doubted his effectiveness as a messenger because of his speech impediment. He stuttered. Gideon doubted that his 300-person army of farmers could defeat a massive enemy. Peter doubted that he could walk on water. Thomas doubted the resurrection unless I touch his wounds. You get the idea. God makes statements that are hard for human ears to believe. Yet he is patient to not give up and show himself to be true. So here's a question I have for you. You don't have to answer unless you like to. What's impossible for you to hear right now from God? I love you. Impossible. I'll protect you. No way. Here's one that I've been wrestling with. I am the giver of all good things. Not one good thing will I withhold from you. I don't see it right now. So here's the other encouragement. Your doubts don't disqualify you. He is patient to show you. Does anybody have anything they'd like to share? All right.
I feel like I always do.
Go for it.
Yeah, that's the Lord's been definitely speaking that to me. Just through other like sermons and things, you know, because it's so easy to do, and nobody wants to admit it, especially in the church. Like, no, I'm full of faith.
Yeah.
But the truth is, I think we all have like doubts, like. Yeah, God, does God love me? Is he going to use, can he use me?
Yeah.
That's the big one. That's a big one that, you know, I wrestle with.
Mm-hmm.
Because you want to be used by the Lord, but, you know, then, you know, the enemy brings up, you know, oh, no, you're a sinner, you know, and you start thinking of yourself in that context, like, oh, yeah, you know, why would God want to use me, you know? So for me, that's a struggle to doubt that, you know, being used by God.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you for sharing. All right, so we're going to finish this up in verse 23.
Sorry, I really briefly. This is...
Oh, come on, Stephen.
Second.
I'm just kidding.
This is the first... he does this twice, right? Because this second one, he does this again in triumphal entry before he's crucified, correct?
That's a good point. Scholars talk about how it's mentioned three times. Mm. And how could it be like in the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke? When did it happen? Is a question that they argue amongst each other. And they think that John put this here on purpose to reflect his main points about the wedding in Cana. So this incident could have happened by the triumphal entry.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So that's what they disagree about.
Okay.
And talk about. So yeah, the other argument was, if Jesus did this the first time, no one's going to let him do it the second time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They know who to watch out for. So verse 23. Now, while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, many people saw the signs he was performing and believed in his name. I think it's interesting. You know, the people's response to Jesus is turning over the tables. What sign do you have? And yet Jesus here in 23 performs so many signs. And people come to believe, and it's believed that these people only believed because they saw great miracles and great signs. They saw a good show. It was based on their feelings, entertainment. It was inauthentic. And that they may have felt good as spectators, but they did not want to be followers. Because look at this in verse 24 through 25. But Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all people. He did not need any testimony about mankind, for he knew what was in each person. Jesus' divine knowledge was able to recognize the shallowness of their faith. He didn't entrust himself to those who were not committed, desiring to follow him. But the opposite of that can be said as well. He entrusts himself to people whose faith is genuine. What it means for Jesus to entrust himself to someone is best understood in John chapter 15. Can someone please read that? Let's go, Kathy. Can you please read John chapter 15, 14 through 15?
You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you.
That's what it means to entrust. Jesus wasn't going to entrust himself to be close to be intimate, to have that relationship with people that just want to spectate and leave whenever they want to. But if you're willing to put your heart into it, even with all of your doubts, I can work with that. And what Stephen prayed earlier today, he said, draw near to me and I will draw near to you. God is more than willing. He wants, he desires that in trusting. He desires, he wants to have that relationship. So I believe that doubting is different from those who wouldn't make a commitment. The heroes of the Old Testament and the disciples doubted, but remained committed to God's purpose and calling. That faith is genuine. Genuine faith has room for doubt.
It's interesting.
Yeah. So, not making a commitment says, no matter what I see or hear is good enough to give my life. I repeat that. Not making a commitment says, no matter what I see or hear is good enough to give my life. Doubting says, I don't understand it. It's hard for me to comprehend. I believe, but help my unbelief.
What happens in... somebody has doubts, but he does not have the desire to learn. With time, just forgets about the whole thing instead of moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Stay there and then eventually move backwards.
I think that's,
does that happen?
That's giving into your doubts.
Yeah.
So you can doubt and press forward. It's in here where when Jesus talks about the, you have to eat my flesh and drink my blood, and then he loses a whole bunch of disciples.
Yeah.
Turn to the 12 and says, are you guys leaving too? And Peter just says, where else are we going to go? Like, to me, I was like, it was probably weird to hear what he was saying, but he was like, well, I don't know. I mean, we know who you are. Like, I mean, maybe I don't understand, but I'm still following you because I know you're the way to heaven. That's and that's how I've felt many times in my life. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't understand, but like, where else am I going to turn? Like, I know there's no other way. Like,
mm-hmm.
So I think that's not giving into the doubt. Giving into doubt is turning and bailing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I think the Lord can use those doubts to strengthen your faith. You go deeper. You end up going deeper.
Because you want to know.
Because you want to know, exactly. Yeah.
That's good. Thanks for sharing that, man. Yeah, and the reason also I didn't go into chapter 3 tonight is because I didn't know this, but chapter 3 and chapter 4 are the same thing as what Cana and the temple are. They're parallel.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to get into that next week. And here's your homework, Stephen. if you guys want to do that too. But before we end tonight, I'd love to hear what's one thing you want to take away. What's one thing you want to take away from tonight's lesson? Something that you want to wrestle with the Lord possibly or encourage your faith with? And I'll pause it here so it could be...